Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Happy COVID summer vacation, and like all summer vacations, as soon as it starts, you begin to worry about when it's going to end. And just like those September clouds were always on my horizon in July, well, there are some clouds on our horizon as well, and they have a big Greek delta printed on them. Right now, in your county or your state, but you should be looking at the county level, you may get a COVID summer vacation. You may get to walk around without a mask, go inside without a mask, and it's probably pretty safe if you're vaccinated to be doing that. However, the times may change. It's a good bet they will. We're going to talk a little bit about evolution. And remember, there was a book a long time ago called The Selfish Gene. Very good book. You could read an excerpt on Wikipedia. But basically, the gist of it is that we and our civilization and our entire lives are nothing more than a vehicle to optimize the production of more human DNA, more human genes. All the genes care about is making more genes. And however they do it and what other incidental things happen, like civilization, well, that's good as long as it fits the evolutionary goal. And when we talk about COVID, we're dealing with a entity, I think it's fair to call it an entity, in the Platonian sense at least, that is working off of that kind of playbook. Its purpose is to spread around as much as possible, to infect as many people as possible, because every infection leads to billions of copies of the virus being made, and that's how you get your evolutionary points. So naturally, when you're making all those copies, little mistakes, little typos can be made. Little autocorrects happen. And sometimes those autocorrects are funny, just like the ones on your phone. Sometimes they're more efficient, or they change something in a way that, well, improves the ability of that particular lineage to fulfill its evolutionary goal, in the case of COVID, to transmit as widely as possible. Hence, Delta and Lambda. Two clouds on our summer vacation horizon. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about this, and I want to emphasize that the transmissibility of this is silent. We know that people who have been vaccinated with the mRNA vaccines, that's where we have the most data, are not going to get very sick from Delta. The protection, and we have good data on this from England, which has a lot of Delta, is about 88% for getting sick. We really don't know for sure what the protection is for being contagious, however, because one of the problems with this particular virus is probably 40%. I've seen figures as high as 60%. Of course, depends on your discipline and your region. But at least 40% of cases are probably conveyed by people who don't realize that they can spread virus. That's why the masks were so helpful and will continue to be helpful, regardless of which variant we're dealing with. If you are silently spreading, fully vaccinated, but one of the maybe 5 to 10% who can silently spread, get it for a couple of days. During that couple of days, well, you could give it to somebody who might get very, very sick. The Delta virus, according to some research coming out from Australia, is much more contagious. This is an anecdotal report. We do know that Delta, which showed up initially in India, is more transmittable across all the age groups, including children. Children don't get as sick, but they can sure spread it. Also, there's one anecdotal report. This has not been studied scientifically, but because in Australia they still have really good contact tracing, they were able to identify a person who essentially was shopping in I guess probably an indoor mall, and they stood next to somebody who was positive for 10 seconds. That's the only contact that they had with anyone who was positive, and they got COVID. So neither person was masked. That's important to understand. But the 10-second thing, that's probably a real super spreader event that didn't go, pardon my expression, viral simply because of lack of opportunity. But that's not a lot of time. We don't know if that's going to pan out. That needs to be studied. I want to emphasize this is anecdotal and probably not universalizable, or if it was that bad, half the population of India would be dead at this point, and they're not. So I'm not trying to sow panic. And right now in California, we're in very good shape, particularly the 19 million people who've gotten their vaccination. And I want to talk a little bit about vaccine hesitancy now. Of the vaccinated between January 1st and June 17th, and this is before Delta got here. Delta, by the way, is showing up in California now, but it is not a high percentage. However, just going with the old version of the virus, there were 6,900 confirmed post-vaccination infections. That works out to 0.03% of all of the infections in the case, and of those, 500 people were hospitalized. So 7% of the vaccinated, which is really close to the 94-93% protection rate, almost nobody died. The point I want to emphasize here is that vaccination is still incredibly protective. One of the things we are seeing is that younger people are not getting vaccinated. A little phrase crossed my mind, and I don't mean to be discriminatory. I'm trying to be funny here. But as a boomer, I remember, I was a late boomer, however. Anyway, don't trust anyone over 30. That was kind of a 1960s expression. That was the 1960s expression for us young boomers. Now, as an old boomer, I'm wondering if I need to dust it off, change the wording and say, don't trust anyone under 30. Because unfortunately, that group has the lowest vaccinations. We're talking about basically, if between 18 and 39, only 34%. The rate is substantially lower among 18 to 24-year-olds. So those are the individuals that really are at risk of killing somebody accidentally. Do you want to kill a stranger? And do you want to risk killing a stranger? What if there actually is karma here? What if you could have avoided killing that person? Is it truly involuntary manslaughter if you chose not to wear a mask or chose not to get vaccinated? I'll leave that to the philosophers. But I do want to point out that this is a game of chess with a virus. If you're playing with a chess master, and I would say that this bug is definitely a chess master, the way you lose when you're playing with someone in chess who's better than you is you make a mistake. You give them an opening. So don't give this chess master virus an opening. Get yourself vaccinated. I had a conversation the other day with someone who was asking about a family member who had rheumatoid arthritis and was really worried that her autoimmune disease would be flared. I had another question from an acquaintance about someone with Crohn's. Yes, it was Crohn's disease, which is an inflammatory disease of the colon. Now, if you have Crohn's disease or rheumatoid arthritis, and you get COVID, the odds of you having a big flare and a bad flare and maybe a persistent flare of your autoimmune disease is really, really high. If you get the vaccine, the odds of having a small flare is not zero. Big flares we're not seeing. One out of four people who gets COVID has persistent illness. A lot of them are new. A lot of them are flares of old illnesses. Wherever you're weak, the inflammation that's generated by this virus taking out some of your basic anti-inflammatory apparatus, and that's what's going on here. The virus damages your own ability to fight all sources of inflammation. You don't want this virus. I want to point out that the vaccine does not do this. The vaccine does not damage the anti-inflammatory apparatus. So you don't get long COVID from vaccine, but you can get sore and you can feel achy and flu-like. And that's from your immune system reacting, but it doesn't last. We know this, okay? We've got the data. We have what are we now, July? We've got six-month data. And it hasn't emerged that there are major flares of autoimmune disease from the vaccine. What has emerged is that you may need a booster shot if you're immunosuppressed. Well, okay. But for those who are hyperimmune, we're not seeing what they're worried about. And I just want to say, I think we'd be seeing it by now. I don't think anybody is suppressing the data. We're looking at a virus now that is starting to spread. I heard a statistic, it's close to 30% of what's showing up in the current flares in the Midwest. And it's up to 50% of the hospitalizations because guess what? People seem to be getting sicker. Wow. And we don't want to get vaccinated by something we know will work. I don't quite understand it. If you have a question about this, and I can help you out with that, then please wait for more data. You've got a couple of months probably before it gets colder, before the kids go back to school, before we see a flare in this state, because we've got pretty high vaccination rates. So what I recommend is watch your state data and watch your county data. Your county data is more important. How many cases are you likely to walk past in a given day, especially if that Australian report was true? How many people who aren't wearing a mask? You know, you can't walk up to people and ask for their vaccine card. Part of me wishes I could, but that's not how our country works. Our country works on trust and mutual regard and mutual respect and a desire to protect and help the weak. Women and children first. Well, let's just take those values, if we're so patriotic and think our country is so great. I want to see those values. I really do. I want you to show me your values by getting vaccinated and helping to protect people. And please transcend your fear. When that virus comes back, and it will, you want to be protected. A little inconvenience now. I think the whole microchip sterilization stuff, I think that's kind of, most people aren't carrying that meme around in their head anymore, I hope. Certainly not here. So this is an appeal to the younger people in my county, especially. Please get yourself vaccinated. And everybody else, watch the skies, watch your county, and go back to July of 2020 behavior when the rates here start to go up. We're not there yet. We have a respite. Happy summer vacation. But like all summer vacations, eventually they have to end. I'm going to take a moment and read an email. This is from Brad. Came in a couple of weeks ago, but I wanted to make sure that I gave it a fair discussion. And it's perfect because we're talking about microbes and microbiota. I don't know if you can refer to a virus as biota because it's not strictly speaking alive. It's kind of an evil viral program, except wait, it's a virus. Okay. Tuberculosis BCG. Dr. Dawn, you recently mentioned that the world did not have a very good vaccine for tuberculosis. The CDC does not recommend BCG in the USA, although it is used in many other countries. According to the National Health Service, this would be England, in 7 to 8 of every 10 people who have the vaccine, it's effective against the most severe form of TB, such as TB meningitis in children. It's less effective in preventing TB that affects the lung, which is the more common type. It's about 50% protective for pulmonary infections. But more importantly, well, maybe not even 50%, I should say it's about 30%. There are a bunch of different reviews. But as of 2014, they were saying 30% effective to reduce infections, particularly reduce contagious infections, which generally are the pulmonary variety, by the way. But it reduced progression to active TB. So what are we talking about here? Unlike COVID, in many ways, this is a very sophisticated bacterium. The mycobacterium are coated with a kind of waxy coating that acts like sort of Harry Potter's invisibility cape to hide the bacteria from the immune system. That's an important part of how TB works. You breathe it into your lungs. It gets there into the tiny little bits, which is where COVID goes too. But once it gets there, it just settles down, reproduces for a while, makes a seed, and sits there. The immune system can't see it. So it hides out and it waits for you to get weak. It waits for you to have cancer and need chemotherapy. It waits for you to get old and then re-erupts. And it can also, during its initial phases, if you get a primary pulmonary infection, it can spread to your bloodstream. It can go to your bones and it can go to your brain. And when that happens, you get very, very sick. And by the way, the drugs that we use for tuberculosis are not happy making drugs. There's a lot of resistant tuberculosis out there, and the drugs that we have to use are heavy drugs that can cause substantial side effects on their own. But they definitely beat getting tuberculosis. So I would say that it's not a very good vaccine. It's helpful. It's an okay vaccine, and it prevents some of the major complications. So I stand by my statements. However, I do want to point out that even if we reduce contagiousness by 30%, that's substantial when you're talking about a population. One of the things that helps us with TB is that it requires prolonged contact, usually, although you do get your occasional super spreader event. I would say for the last decade, that's why I've carried a mask when I was on an airplane. And the reason I've carried the mask is if I'm sitting in a row or behind or in front of someone who's coughing a lot, I just pull my mask out and put it on. It makes me feel safer. And in terms of protecting me from tuberculosis, which is what I used to be worried about before last year, it's actually quite effective. So I hope that's a little walk in the park on TB. Recently, I saw some data, which Brad doesn't refer to here in his email, that there may be a protection against pulmonary COVID from BCG vaccine. This was one of these preliminary reports. It was epidemiology. And I want to emphasize, epidemiology is for hypothesis generation. You observe the population, you see a correlation between two things, in this case, having had BCG and not getting pulmonary COVID, and you postulate that maybe there's a cause and effect there. Maybe there's a connection. Maybe it's helpful. But you can't prove it. That's not the way science works. You have to prove causality. You have to understand that groups are non-standard and that an observation can be influenced by lots of other factors that you have to control for. In the case of severe COVID, or even identifying that you had COVID, because there's lots of stealth cases walking around that never got tested and don't even know they had COVID, right? If 30% of people have asymptomatic COVID, then when they got their vaccine, they didn't know they'd had COVID. And guess what? They did fine. We didn't have a big flare. Maybe they got a sore arm. I don't know. My arm was pretty sore. I don't think I had asymptomatic COVID. I was getting myself tested every week. The point is, what we don't know could fill the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. What we know at any given moment has taken a lot of time to gather. And when the ground shifts, like, for example, a new viral variant emerges, we have to start all over again, studying it, studying its behavior, comparing and contrasting it, and figuring out if the measures that we've been taking are effective. Well, I don't know if they'll be fully effective, but I sure know that they're going to be better than nothing. And so don't throw away your mask. Don't throw away your hand sanitizer. And in fact, you might want to stock up for back to school, or as I'm calling it, back to COVID. Okay, we actually got an email. I think I'm going to refrain from quoting the name of the writer. The email reads, "More COVID alarmism from Dr. Don. So now the unvaccinated are potential murderers. This is fear-mongering at its worst." All right. So, you know, this person is criticizing what I just said, and I'm just going to comment that we should be afraid. We should be careful. And we should consider the unintended consequences of our actions. I do believe that we are responsible for keeping each other safe. So if that's fear-mongering, then I'll accept that title as a title of respect. So thank you very much for your comment. Let's talk about kombucha. Kombucha is a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. And it's like the newest beverage. I go into stores now and there's like three or four shelves of different companies and different kombuchas, and they're all flavored. They've got a little bit of alcohol in them, not very much, not enough to really worry about. And they're made by fermenting sugar. The bacteria and the yeasts use various biological strategies, and I'm not going to go into the deep biochemistry, don't worry, I promise. But traditionally, kombucha is made from the fermentation of black tea. You can also make it with mint, lemon balm, jasmine, green tea. And in reading this article, I found that somebody had actually made it out of oak leaves, of which I have a great abundance on my property, I might add. And the oak leaf version actually was highly anti-inflammatory. Kombucha itself is not as good at anti-inflammatory. So I might try brewing up some oak leaf drink under appropriate sterile conditions, of course. And that's what I first of all want to say. A lot of people do this at home. You need to know what you're doing. If you are experienced in brewing beer, then you know how to avoid contamination. If you're experienced in home canning, then you know what you're doing. If you don't have that level of experience, please go watch some videos or read a book before you start making your own kombucha, because it can go bad on you and have adverse bacteria. The interesting thing is, if you do it right, the bacteria that are growing in there are largely probiotics, and the yeasts are actually beneficial. One of the phenomena that occurs when you make the stuff is that you get this sort of film on the surface. Like it's a fairly thick jelly-like membrane. It's called Zooglea biofilm. It looks kind of like a mushroom cap, and it is extremely important because it protects the bacteria and the yeast from ultraviolet radiation, but it's permeable, so it lets enough oxygen through for the bacteria and the yeast that are clinging to the undersurface to work. Another issue with this is, do you refrigerate it? Do you ferment it in a cool environment? The sweet spot is probably about 12 degrees centigrade, which is, you know, not freezing, but, you know, refrigerator level coolness, I think, if you find the cool part of the refrigerator. So once you've done your fermentation, you can store it in the fridge and you won't damage the bacteria. Now, the fact that this is made of tea is very interesting to me. But before I talk about the tea, I want to talk about the amino acids, because the kombucha, although it's made from tea leaves, the bacteria and the fungi that are growing off the sugar generate a lot of protein. And so the amount of amino acids in the kombucha is actually pretty good. So you've got about 44 milligrams per gram of tea fungus, and that's that's a substantial amount. I wonder if it would be possible to develop a cuisine for the Zooglea, but I haven't heard of such a thing. Would be an interesting thing to try, however, as that biofilm is probably pretty healthy and high in protein. Now, tea acts as an antioxidant, and there's black tea and green tea. Green tea is higher in catechins. These are bioflavonoids, and we'll be talking about those in a little minute. But in the making of black tea, you actually crush the leaves, and then you leave them in a high humidity environment, and that causes an enzymatic reaction. And it kind of ferments a little bit. And during this fermentation, you create new compounds, which are very beneficial in and of themselves. Both of them are strong antioxidants, which means that they are able to scavenge free radicals. They're also very helpful in heavy metal detox. Tea in general is a good chelator, but when you have the tea in the kombucha, it's actually even better. The chelation activity, however, means that you have to be careful about your container. There's been at least one case of lead poisoning associated with someone who was brewing kombucha in a container that I guess was a glazed ceramic that had lead in it, and the kombucha grabbed a ton of lead, and the person actually got lead poisoning. So you need to watch your containers. There's strong evidence that green tea and black tea have effects against cancer that are amplified by this processing by the biofilm of what's called SCOBY, which is the combination of fungus and bacteria that make this. There are studies that show it inhibits the oxidative damage to DNA, so it helps prevent the initiation of cancer, that it inhibits certain chemicals that cancers need to grow, and it inhibits telomerase, which are two things that are out of control in cancer. So if you can inhibit them, you inhibit the cancer without inhibiting normal physiology. So you can induce apoptosis, which is cell death, using kombucha and using the tea catechins, especially green tea. And there's a great deal of data looking at, you know, green tea also for assistance with cardiovascular disease. You can interfere with metastasis by inhibiting fibronectin, which is one of the compounds that the cancer cells create that's only found in embryology, but cancer cells start making it again, and it allows them to stick to the inside of the blood vessel wall so that they can get into a new organ spreading by the bloodstream. Yeah, lots of reasons to love kombucha. And it's also pretty high in minerals. It can act kind of as a supplement. It also contains things that you might actually be taking, glycosaminoglycans. So that would be your glucosamine sulfate and your chondroitin sulfate. Well, that biofilm I'm talking about, a lot of that in kombucha too. So it's starting to look like maybe this is actually a health food, a functional food. And I'm really impressed by the data here. And the final thing that really got my attention is that it helps with liver detoxification. We have a lot of toxins in our environment, plastics, microplastics. I've got an article about that coming up. People who are on hormone supplementation, people who don't have good microbes in their gut are more subject to essentially recycling these toxins and running them through the whole body again, exposing the cells to more damage. If you can improve glucuronidation, which is one of the more important ways that we get rid of these hormone disruptors, then you can really help stabilize biology and help us deal with our environmental challenges. It's a low toxicity compound, particularly if it's made in controlled situations. So know what you're doing. It does contain heparin, potentially, and some studies have suggested maybe if you're pregnant, you shouldn't drink large quantities of it, but that's not been confirmed. Obviously, doing research on pregnant women is difficult to get past the Human Subjects Committee for good reasons. So where we stand on kombucha, looks like a good functional food. Probably want the ones that don't taste very sweet and have low calorie content, but it's like taking your own kind of probiotic. So go for it. My recommendation, give it a shot. We're going to go to our first caller of the day. Please tell me your name and where you're from.
Yeah, my name is Joe, and I'm from Santa Cruz.
Hi. What can I do for you?
About a dozen years ago, I had an allergic reaction to penicillin. Mm-hmm. And I was recently reading that a one-time reaction may not be a death sentence, that there's a way that you can test a penicillin allergy skin test.
Right.
And I was curious how you would go about obtaining that.
Okay, that's an excellent question. A lot of times people have, first of all, anaphylaxis, that's a massive allergic reaction. Sometimes people have a faint after a shot. That might be a problem. If you get wheezing, hives, throat tightness, that's generally the person, if that happens within, you know, say 15, 20 minutes of a penicillin shot, you know, that's the person we're most worried about. But a lot of people get a rash, or they feel queasy, or they get a GI upset. And so the severity of the reaction is important in deciding whether or not you even need to worry about it. A lot of times if someone tells me they had a penicillin reaction, the next question I ask them is, well, have you ever had Keflex or any antibiotic, cephalexin? Have you had a shot for VD? Because we use Rocephin, which is ceftriaxone. We use that for gonorrhea. So, you know, I'll sort of say, well, have you had the cousin, because if you had the cousin and you didn't react, then I think you're a real good candidate for a challenge test, because the odds are excellent that you'd pass it. Now, in an emergency situation, which I was really fearful back last year in the early spring, like March of 2020, I didn't know how bad things were going to get. Nobody knew how bad things were going to get. I was like, okay, I better read up on these protocols because I might have to give someone a penicillin test before I treated them because I might just be the only available person to treat. I mean, you know, we have these fantasies, right, as doctors. But what you do? Make sure you have some adrenaline handy. Because if the person does, you know, grab their throat and keel over, you want to be able to give them an adrenaline shot because, yep, they're penicillin allergic. But mostly what you do is you give a very small dose in the skin. You remember the old TB test where they put a little needle in, under your skin and raise a little bump? Yeah. That test, we usually use blood tests now. The QuantiFERON test is sort of superseded the old skin test. But the old skin test, you know, you still find it. Anyway, it's very similar to that. So a little bit of is put under your skin, and you watch for a reaction. And if you get a hive or any kind of skin reaction, then you consider that to be a positive. If you don't, then you feel pretty confident moving forward with oral dosing. If it's an intravenous dose, like, for example, a hospital setting, or you're going to give somebody a big butt shot of penicillin, not done very much anymore, then under that circumstance, I'd probably keep him in my office for an hour or so until the stuff hit the bloodstream to make sure that they were going to be okay. That's basically how it looks. In our county, because we have an abundance of medical services, you'd probably get that done at an allergist's office rather than at a primary care office. But certain primary care doctors who, you know, are in private practice or maybe even working for the safety net clinics might be doing it on their own in a supported setting, because you do want to be sure that if you precipitate something, you can deal with whatever you've triggered.
Yeah, well, the reason I'm asking is that I recently had to have a dental implant, and because I had identified myself as allergic to penicillin, they had to give me an antibiotic for the tooth implant, and what they give me was clindamycin.
I hate that drug.
And that's the most foul-tasting stuff I don't ever want to have to take that again. So I thought, well, if I can take penicillin instead of that, then happy days, you know?
Well, there's that, but also, did you have just like one injection of it, or did you have it for several days?
There's a pills, and 300 milligram in a capsule form that...
How long?
At 3 a day for 7 days.
All right. So that's enough to really mess up your microbiome. So I'm going to give you your microbiome rehab plan here. Okay.
Yes.
So how do you feel about sauerkraut?
I love it.
Great.
I have sauerkraut and
All right. So basically, two servings of fermented food a day. So you could be yogurt and sauerkraut. Could be, you know, 12 ounces of kombucha and yogurt sauerkraut. Mixing it up is good. If you want to do three servings, that's awesome too. You also need a root vegetable. And try to get as big a variety of root vegetables as you can. My favorite of all the root vegetables, but it's hard to find, is something called sunchokes. And I planted one, but it didn't like my yard, so I don't know. It wasn't the suitable environment. So I don't have sunchokes growing in my garden, unfortunately, but I'm going to try again. I'll have to do some reading. Sunchokes have high levels of inulin. Jerusalem artichoke, that's another one you can buy. Inulin's also in the tree larch. You can buy it as a supplement. But jicama, which is widely available and keeps quite well in the fridge and is a decent substitute for potato chips with if you're, you know, dishing up some guacamole or some bean dip. So jicama is an excellent source of inulin and cheap. And then there's, you know, there's your rutabagas, your turnips, your parsnips, your carrots, your beets. And try to eat a different root vegetable. The more variety that you eat, the better. They're quite good. Some of the stronger tasting ones, like the parsnips and the turnips, they're wonderful roasted. It brings out the sweetness. And the wider the variety of diet, the better you're going to do at getting a wider variety of bacteria, because they all have their favorite food. And so building back that diversity, which got just torched by the clindamycin, has the advantage there. There's one supplement I would recommend, and that's Saccharomyces boulardii. It's a beneficial yeast that suppresses the growth of C. difficile. And one of the problems with Clinda is a lot of people get C. difficile after they've taken it. It's a risk factor. C. difficile is not affected by clindamycin. Everything else is. So essentially you have, I was talking about evolution earlier in the program. I don't know if you caught it, but hey, Darwin, right? Evolution, you think of Darwin, you think of Darwin's finches. Well, Darwin went to these islands that were isolated, and they didn't have any mammals. They didn't have any rats. They didn't have any shrews. So the birds that were on this island mutated in amazing ways to do all of the jobs that, you know, all of the food niches that would normally be inhabited by other animals. These birds, like, changed their beaks, and they just developed, you know, the Swiss Army knife of evolution to exploit all the available food. And that's what happens here. If you have a lot of available food and just one bacteria left standing, it's going to overgrow. And unfortunately, C. difficile produces a toxin, which is poisonous. And it can be very hard to get rid of once it gets established. So Saccharomyces boulardii, about 500 milligrams. S-A-C-C-H-A-R-O-M-Y-C-E-S. And then just look for the second word, just look for something that looks like boulevard. If you write Saccharomyces, no matter how you spell it, and then new word, boulevardii, it will come up on the search. Google's very good about my bad spelling, so I know it will handle yours.
I've had that experience on Google. They're really great.
You know, and I'm sure there's other
search engines.
I'm afraid I'm a fangirl for Google, though, and it's not likely to change. But you never know.
Yes. That's a huge help, because that was a concern of mine, and I will try to avoid clindamycin as much as possible in the future. So thank you so much.
Good luck, and I hope that penicillin test turns out right.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. So we're going to now take one from anonymous person in Scotts Valley, who writes, diagnosing something wrong with my heart. After being a very active walker, I've developed a problem. When I exert, even on a small hill, I get lightheaded and feel like I will faint. I stop and let my head clear and then go on. This has increased over the last 4 or 5 years until now I have a problem with even small grades. I've done all the heart tests through Sutter Pamph, and they show nothing wrong with my heart. Treadmill stress tests, echocardiogram monitor. Yet the symptoms are very real. I'm 77 years old. I know you're not a cardiologist, but do you think you could help if I came to you? My cardiologist said that there were a couple of anomalies with my heart, but they were not causing my symptoms. First of all, I want to say that you are exactly the kind of patient I love to invite to come see me over on Mission Street, because you've had a negative medical workup. So I'm reasonably certain that if we mess around in functional medicine land and we do some other things nutritionally, or maybe some acupuncture, depending, in your case, I think probably not, I'm not worried that I'm delaying medical care that could be life-saving, because you've already been screened. But you're still having a problem. And the way you describe the problem, I've got two things in mind. And one of them is autonomic dysfunction, which a lot of people with long COVID are having. And I don't know what's going on. Maybe some environmental factor. That's where my head always goes, is environmental toxicity. But more and more people are developing problems with fainting. In your case, because it's exertional, that definitely makes me want to look at something called diastolic dysfunction. So I'm going to want to look at that echocardiogram and see whether or not your heart is beating just fine. Remember, when you get an echo, you're lying on a table, flat on your back. The question is your heart filling just fine? It can be contracting and emptying, and empty 70-65%, that would be a normal result. But what if you're emptying a lower volume and you're not filling completely? That can happen if the heart's unable to relax. In regular medicine, it's like, oh, well, that's an aging change and we can't do anything about it. In functional medicine, we can do something about it. We go to the root causes in functional medicine. Other things I'd want to look at and you would be whether you had a mitochondrial injury, so that when you actually asked your heart muscle to work harder, it couldn't. There's a lot that could cause that, but top of the list, just for things you may have heard of, certain mold toxins and heavy metal toxins, poisoning, environmental poisoning that could be related to your environment. And I'll just say, you're up in Scotts Valley. Well, we just had a major pollution event. It was called the Lightning Complex Fire. A whole bunch of buildings burned. Many of those buildings had lead paint. Much of the lead went up to the air. And then with the coastal fog and the rain and the dew, it came down again. It may not have come down in your yard. On the other hand, it may very well have. That's something that we need anytime anyone starts showing up with unusual fatigue or a change in their exercise tolerance. Once we've ruled out the usual suspects, we need to start thinking about the outliers. And we had an outlier event, which raises my index of suspicion for this quite a bit. So I'm just using this person's email to emphasize that functional medicine picks up where conventional medicine leaves off. And conventional medicine and functional medicine, if we can figure out how to do them together and figure out our protocols, we can not only take care of the 70% of people or the 80% of people that are going to do just fine with conventional therapy, we can also take care of that 10 or 20% who just don't get better and yet there's nothing to be found. We'd be rounding up some usual suspects ourselves on you if you come to the office, and that's basically how I would approach it. Now, I mentioned I was going to talk about microplastics, and in the context of the earlier article I mentioned about how kombucha helps our body deal with compounds like plastics that we're absorbing, let's talk about microplastics and talk about unintended consequences. I'm going to begin with the end, with the conclusion here, which is there's a couple of things that you can do. One of them is don't buy clothing made out of recycled soda bottles. It seems like a great idea, but that is one of the major sources of microplastics that are heading into the environment and heading into the food chain. And it doesn't matter where you go. You could be at Yellowstone, you could be at Bryce Canyon, you could be in a pine forest in Oregon. When you take a deep breath, you're going to find some microplastic. And that's because they're everywhere. They've gotten into the air, and there is 1,000 tons of it currently floating in the western U.S., and when it rains, it comes down and it gets into the soil. This is coming out of modeling that the National Academy of Sciences published a couple months ago.
But the washing machine connection with recycled plastic clothing came as a surprise.
Guess what the other one is? Freeways. Tires. Tires rub and wear down, and there's a lot of plastic in tires. These tiny little fragments blow on the wind. They go everywhere. But you can look at proximity to a road, and you're going to find a couple of things. You're going to find, if it's an older road, you're going to find lead in the soil, and you're going to find
an ever-increasing amount of microplastics as you approach any road.
So you know those HEPA air filter cleaners that people started buying for COVID, and it turned out they were really, really handy after the fires here in Northern California? Well, they're also really good for catching microplastics. And I am just telling everybody to use one in your bedroom. You spend 8 hours in that room. And if you can keep that air clean, you're really helping your body cleanse itself, breathe some air, and maybe get rid of some of the plastic burden. The more the merrier. But I'm very big on air filtering now in the aftermath of my, unfortunately, ever-increasing understanding of how these very tiny particles of carbon, virus, plastic, and metal can get way down into your lung and from there into your bloodstream and basically go everywhere, go anywhere. We've got a evolutionary shift going on, right? We're going to have to figure it out. We've changed our environment, and when you change your environment, you change your biology. So I've got about a few minutes and no callers. I think I will do emails. That's more useful, I think, to the general population than the deep science dive I had planned. I know I love those, but I think I've hit you with enough science today. So let's go with Sue in Fremont. Hello, I'm interested in understanding how to take calcium, magnesium, and zinc when you have osteoporosis and sleep problems. Online articles seem to be all over the map and whether you can take them together versus separately. I started taking Solaray, 1,000 calcium, 500 milligrams magnesium, and 25 of zinc, but it doesn't seem to be enough calcium. I think she means it does seem to be enough calcium, but taking more magnesium gives me diarrhea. Also, the magnesium was recommended to help with pain. So let me start, Sue, by saying that I generally tell people if you're going to do calcium supplements, calcium alone is not going to do the job. 800 milligrams is good. If you can get that from diet, that's better. And I want to tell you about a website called My Food Data. And My Food Data is a really excellent website for getting like foods with high calcium content. I'd rather you got your calcium from diet. It's hard to get magnesium at those levels because of magnesium depletion of the soil. So you probably want about 800 milligrams of magnesium. But you also want to get some vitamin K2 and at least 50 micrograms of MK7, which is a subtype of vitamin K2. And you want to get some vitamin D so that you can be sure that you absorb those things. One last thing, got to get enough protein. And fish collagen is the best, or make your own bone broth out of grass-fed beef, and you're in business. But that contains a lot of the items you need in a very absorbable form. The vitamin K is super important, though, as is the vitamin D. Zinc, 30 milligrams, that's fine. With respect to the magnesium, I find most people, if they're trying to sleep, use magnesium glycinate, 300 milligrams, three or four times a day. You got to spread it out. Find the dose you can tolerate and keep taking it. It's better if you take it with food. That seems to help with the diarrhea aspect of it. Whatever you poop out is not absorbed into your body, so you've just wasted it. If you do take zinc, you need to get some copper. You can induce a copper deficiency if you take too much zinc. And you need, for every 10 milligrams of zinc, you need about 1 milligram of copper to avoid long-term deficiencies. So we're going to go now to the phones. We're talking to Pablo. Hello, Pablo.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Well, you're welcome.
Yes. I sent you an email, but now I decided to call you. My question is, how can I lower my diastolic blood pressure? I seem to be, you know, following all the general guidelines for a healthy life, but still my blood pressure seems to be around 90, so that's a little too high to be permanently.
Yeah, your diastolic, the lower of the two numbers, is 90. Yeah, that's wear and tear on your system. So you're right. You want to get that down. Okay, so first of all, regular exercise, and we're talking about walking, bicycling, nothing super strenuous. We're not talking weightlifting, although you can lift weights. I don't recommend it in people who already have high blood pressure until they get their pressure down.
I do walk every day, okay, at least half an hour in the
Good.
Mountain.
All right. So you got that one down. So the next thing is making sure that you eat an appropriate diet. And what's appropriate? You want lots of fruits and vegetables. You do want adequate calcium and magnesium, and I'll come back to that. But you want a good supply of fruits and vegetables. 7 1/2-cup servings. So that would be 3 1/2 cups of fruits and vegetables a day. It's okay if you blend that into a smoothie or cook it into a soup. I love my Instapot. I make what I call a warm green smoothie. And just whatever vegetables are in the fridge or whatever's cheap at the farmer's market goes into the pressure cooker and gets run through the blender and gets consumed over the next couple of days. That's an extremely easy way to get those servings in. It's hard to change your eating habits, but it's easy to drink cup of the stuff every day. So that's a strategy. Mm. But you need to think, okay, I've got 3 1/2 cups. How am I going to get it? And by the way, if we're talking lettuce, it's a cup. The only serving, if it's cooked spinach, it's half a cup. If it's raw spinach, it's a full cup, because you know how that stuff cooks down. So now we've talked about the fruits and vegetables. Adequate calcium is important. Dairy's okay. If you tolerate dairy, if you don't tolerate dairy, there's plenty of other sources of calcium. Again, that My Food Data website is excellent for telling you how to get any nutrient and work it into your diet. The magnesium, you have to add back in. It's not in those fruits and vegetables. It hasn't been for 100 years since we introduced commercial fertilizer. So you basically have to go get your own magnesium as a mineral.
Okay, so if I get a supplement with calcium and
right.
magnesium?
I would recommend magnesium glycinate, 300 milligrams. Get 100 or 150 milligram capsules until you figure out your dose. Take 300 milligrams three times a day. All right? That's basically step one on getting the blood pressure down. You've got the exercise, increase the fruits and vegetables, work on your stress, just deep breathing.
How much calcium?
800 to 1,000 milligrams, but you'll have to break it up into at least two doses.
Okay.
But if you get it from food, that counts. So go look at that food list that
okay.
I mentioned. Once you've done that, give that about a month. And while you're doing it, deep breathing every day, work on your stress. Because stress is a huge driver. And if you just spend 5 or 10 minutes a day doing deep breathing exercises, real slow deep breathing, you can find 1,000 things that'll tell you that on the web. Just those things alone, half the time, will do the trick. I've got to go. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Have a good night.
Bye.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.